This is the Afternoon Magazine. Good afternoon. I'm Celeste Quinn. Thanks so much for joining us today. Politics and barbecues go so naturally together because it takes the same amount of time to cook the meat as it does to stroke the voters. That dispatch came from the Oklahoma Office of the Works Progress Administration's America Eats Project. On the program today, November 11th, 2008, 1 week after the election, on this Veterans Day, we'll revisit America Eats with our guest, Pat Willard. Pat Willard is the author of America Eats, On the Road with the WPA, the fish fries, box supper, socials, and chitlin feasts that define real American food. The book is based on material written in the 1930s by out-of-work writers and others for the Works Progress Administration, the WPA. The writers included Eudora Welty, Saul Bellow, Ralph Ellison, Richard Wright, and Nelson Algren. Others who worked on the project included librarians and housewives. They were to produce collectively a book about local events where food was served. Listeners, you can join our conversation with the telephone call. We look forward to your questions and comments. The number in the Champaign-Urbana area is 333-9455. That's 333-WILL. We also have a toll-free number. The toll-free number is 800-222-9455. 800-222-WILL. Pat Willard's work has appeared in Bon Appetit, Ladies Home Journal, American Heritage, and the Los Angeles Times. She's the author of four books. Her previous books are also about food. They are Pie Every Day, A Soothing Broth, and Secrets of Saffron. America Eats, On the Road with the WPA, is published by Bloomsbury. 333-9455, toll-free 800-222-9455. Pat Willard, so good to talk with you. How are you?
Good. How are you, Sam?
I'm fine, thanks. Good. Barbecue and politics. I think we do need to raise a civic voice for digging a trench.
That's my heartfelt opinion.
Yeah,
on that one.
We don't really see rallies like the one I mentioned just a moment ago.
You don't. And actually, one of the things I found so wonderful in traveling was there were some small versions of them in other parts of the country, in the South and in the Midwest. And being from the Northeast, we just don't have that. And, you know, basically in New York, you just are not privy to seeing your representative up close. And, for instance, at one instance that I went to, spitting watermelon seeds, you know, across the stage. You know, this is a guy you might want to really vote for, to see how he spits watermelon seeds.
Yeah. Well, here in this part of the country, we see politicians at fairs, at our sweet corn festivals,
right,
at parade time,
yeah,
4th of July and that kind of thing. But I've never seen a politician spit a watermelon seed.
Yeah, you get to have a, you know, up-close relationship with them. You can see how they're, you know, there's nothing like watching someone eat a rib or, you know, an ear of corn and talking to you at the same time. You get a sense of them.
Yeah. Well, in those days, back in the 30s and the 20s, yeah, and the 40s, what were those rallies like that served barbecue?
Well, remember that, you know, they only really had radio to get in touch with the readers, the voters. So even national politicians were going to these itty-bitty little fairs, and they would get on a little stage or a little, you know, a box and say, you know, do an oratory speech, and it would be probably very riveting because these people really knew how to talk and give a speech. The whole, you know, St. James Bible kind of oratory was right there. And so folks would just mill around or sit on the grass and listen to them. It was sort of their entertainment for the afternoon. And then the politicians would come down, and they were expected to sit down and have a meal where voters could still talk to them. So it was a really long afternoon of getting people to know you.
Mm. I'm here with you on Main Street. That's what the politicians of the day were trying to do.
That's exactly what they were trying to say.
I'm an ordinary guy just like you.
Yeah, I'm going to wipe my mouth with my tie, you know. And that's what they really want. And I do believe you get it's a wonderful process of our democracy. If we could just do that again in just little bits, but our world is so changed that Secret Service would never let us get as close to those folks who ran it.
Yeah. What was the barbecue of the day like? How did it differ region to region, place to place?
Well, that was one of the interesting things that came up in the book. Back then, there wasn't such a homogenous sense of food. So like Northerners and Midwesterners, for the most part, and people from California, they had to go to the regions where barbecue was, and it really depended on who populated the area from the beginning. So, for instance, in the South, you got a lot, and the farther north you got, it was a real saucy kind of barbecue where you mopped it and you rubbed it, and it was all kinds of tomato based or vinegar based sauces that you just really soaked the meat in, and they would wrap it up in cloth and then bury it in the ground. And so they would smoke it and drench it. That's basically what they're for. But then as you go west, first of all, the quality of the meat gets a little fresher, and it goes into beef as opposed to pork, and it becomes dry rubs. And that really was based on the Spanish culture that conquered the land. So the Spanish heritage is to take whole spices and peppers and ground them down. And so that's where you get the Texas barbecue kind of thing, mm-hmm. which is really just, spices. And if you go up to Kansas City, there's a combination of that where there's the sauces tend to be very thick with spices, almost like a paste.
And how well have we done in terms of preserving these different styles? When you go to a barbecue restaurant today, and as you know, that's where we get barbecue today in the restaurant.
Right.
How have we done in terms of preserving the barbecue styles of years gone by?
Well, I think it's a mixed bag. I mean, we just crossed so many borders now. So what we think of barbecue is become, first of all, it's become watered down in a commercial sense. Barbecue is, you can go to the supermarket and get all these weird barbecue sauces that who knows what's in them. And there used to be this enormous pride within communities of, individual communities would have their known barbecue cook, and you would get that person for a rally or a special occasion. Only that person, usually was a man, and he would come and he would make the barbecue and dig the pit and everything. But the thing that kind of makes me hopeful is that because it's so identifiable as a unique thing in American culture, we're all interested in how to make a barbecue sauce, and so we're all constantly trying to individualize it with our own taste. And I think that's kind of a cool, unique thing in America, that there are no set national dishes. Mm-hmm. We always bring our own sensibility to them. And that's quite different than other cultures.
Yeah. It's interesting that barbecue and chili are two foods or two types of foods where we have contests.
Yeah.
All the time.
Well, but that the other part of that is the dishes that are contested, for instance, Brunswick stew and bouillabaisse, there'll be kick-ups for those, and people making them and figuring out which is the best one. And they're very regional dishes.
Yeah, what's bouillabaisse?
Bouillabaisse is actually a Midwest dish, and it's there's a couple of thoughts about where it came from. People thought that it was came from the French traders and was a corrupt form of bouillabaisse, but it's not. I don't know where that tradition came from. Mostly it's around Minnesota. And what it is a very thick stew made out of oxtails and chicken and sometimes ham and beef, and is cooked for about 24 hours with lots of bones in it and lots of vegetables. And the meat becomes very filament-like, so it's just, you can stand they cook in a big, like, witch's cauldron, and they start with a paddle. And when it's finished, the paddle will stand upright on its own. That's how thick it is. And if you go anywhere in St. Paul, in Minneapolis, they have these little huts called Booyah Huts out in the parks where people will go and cook up big vats of this stuff.
And how is it? What does it taste like?
Well,
an acquired taste?
No. It depends on who's cooking it. So there's this big scandal going on when I was out in St. Paul because there was this one folks who were putting allspice into it, and the other cooks in the cook-off were just thought that was so appalling. And another group put wine into it, which I have to say really added to the flavor. It's almost like a chili, but sort of a bland chili. I'll probably get killed if I ever go to St. Paul's. But it's an acquired taste, yeah.
Yeah, and what's it served with?
Oh, you don't want to serve it with anything.
No,
it's
just
a meal unto itself.
You just need a big spoon. Huh?
You need a huge spoon, yeah.
Well, tell us about the research that you did for this book, where this adventure took you all over the country.
Yeah, well, these papers have been around for so long, and people have tried to figure out what to do with them, and I thought maybe the best way to show modern people what these were was to go back to the places that the original writers actually went to and see how things have been developed. So I went back to the little towns that were written about, and what I loved about it was really off the beaten track. These were, you know, for the most part, really little towns that stayed pretty much the same. I mean, there were still, you know, of course, there were modern influences, but their sensibility about what they were doing, the dishes that didn't quite change that much. So that was kind of interesting. And it was heartening because I think, you know, the food culture is so predominantly, or the food media is so predominantly on the East Coast and West Coast, we don't take into consideration the goodness that's happening in little towns around the country.
This is the Afternoon Magazine. Our guest this afternoon, Pat Willard. She's the author most recently of America Eats, On the Road with the WPA, the fish fries, box supper socials, and chitlin feasts that define real American food. On this day, we're talking about America Eats with our guest, Pat Willard. Her work has appeared in Bon Appetit, Ladies Home Journal, American Heritage, and the Los Angeles Times. America Eats is published by Bloomsbury. Listeners, you can join us this afternoon with questions, comments. We'd love to hear from you. 333-9455, the number in the Champaign-Urbana area, and toll-free 800-222-9455. 333-WILL and 800-222-WILL. We have a listener joining us on line one. Good afternoon.
Hi.
Hi.
I'm actually fascinated with this subject. As it happens, I'm just finishing up an essay about potlucks that I'm writing for a local publication, and and how there seems to be a resurgence of, at least in my group of friends and my social milieu, of potluck dinners. Mm-hmm. And I think part of it could be a response to economic hard times. Part of it could be, a desire for more convivial, you know, activities in an age where we really communicate by text message and cell phone and instant messenger. And I was just wondering if you had any comments about that.
Well, That's one thing that I really just loved about doing the book now, because I think there's certainly lots of parallels. Potlucks were first of all, the way that American food came together was one of the few ways that all these different types of people could sit down and have a common experience. So you had people who were like, you know, if you think about our ancestors, they were from England and, you know, Africa and Well, all over the place. And so mealtime would come, or they were trying to build a community, and they would say, oh, well, you know, let's just get together and we'll bring some food and we'll sit down. So that was the essence of potluck dinners. And the other thing was that, and this was so ingrained in the papers, because they were written during the Great Depression, potluck dinners and community dinners were a way for people to be entertained. And it was very cheap, and one person could share their bounty with other people who may not be doing so well, kind of thing. It was a way that you could benefit other people without, like, calling attention to it. So those two aspects of it were something that I can – there definitely is a resurgence of it, because it is a way for us to get together in a time when we are harried and, you know, the world is just driving us crazy, and I think is that the economic downturn is we can still go out to eat, but we can eat, you know, with these, with our friends, that won't be too burdensome.
Yeah, does the caller want to follow up?
No, I think it's really weird that I just turned on the radio and you guys were talking about
it so
while
neat.
I'm writing an article about the exact same thing.
Yeah.
Now I have to read your book, so I appreciate your response.
There you go.
Oh, good luck.
Thanks for the call this afternoon. I've got another caller here ready to go, but maybe you just talk with us just a little bit, Pat, about the fun feed.
Oh, and it was one of the things I really wanted to find, you know, to find a modern example of it. Maybe, you know, the caller before might, with her potlucks, be interested in this. Fun feeds were in Nebraska and Montana, so the upper West Coast countries, or the Western countries, and they were specifically came together during the Great Depression as a way to, first of all, the winters there are so long. I mean, it gets dark and it's cold, and you don't want to go out. You have no radio. You have really nothing if you think about, you know, the media they had back then, to entertain yourself through these whole times. So what they would do is they would put a couple flyers up around the town square and say, you know, we're going to have a fun feed. And people would come with a dish to, you know, either the local school or the town hall, whatever. And then the folks would get up and do an entertainment. It'd be kind of like a little talent contest. So you'd have some nice woman doing a comedy show, and little Sally coming up and doing a dance, and someone pulling out a harmonica, and that's how they would spend the night together.
Very interesting. Well, let's go ahead and take this next call now. A listener on line two on a cell phone. Good afternoon.
Good afternoon. As a native of Kentucky, I was listening to the description of the dish from Minnesota and couldn't help thinking of burgoo.
Burgoo, I know, yeah.
Which may be etymologically similarly based, but equally sort of unclear about its origins. But
yeah.
the preparation, the ingredients sounded exactly like what burgoo is, which is kind of a cross between barbecue and a stew.
Yeah, well, in the book I lumped those three together because, first of all, they're three pure dishes that you can describe as American frontier dishes, because they're made very much like how our settlers did. They're in these big iron pots.
Yep.
And mostly I got to say that men are considered the cooks in the whole episode of getting this together. They're sauce-based, and then you just put some hunk of something in there and let it cook for like years on end. But isn't burgoo mostly like lamb, or is that?
No, it varies. It's sort
varies?
Of an
okay.
opportunistic thing.
Whatever is hanging out.
Like
and
a
you
cow,
can kill
like
it.
A pig, you know. No roadkill, I don't think. But you put it in a pot with, you know, and it cooks for a long time, and with vegetables and spices.
Right.
And what you said about men doing it, I've done it every year in celebration of the Derby, because that's preeminent appearance. Is after the day after the Derby, the Kentucky Colonels have a big thing at Churchill Downs in Louisville, and they have burgoo. And I've made it for years now on the first Saturday in May myself, is sort of keeping in touch with my roots, as it were.
Well, did you ever see a woman make it in a big bag?
No.
Yeah, that's what I just found that so fascinating, that women were not privy to either the Brunswick stew recipes or the bouillon or the burgoo recipes. And in the book, I pointed out that they were such closely guarded secrets that it was like the grandfather whispering the recipe to the to his son on the deathbed, you know, because women just didn't want, for whatever reason,
to some extent, I think, there was no recipe.
There wasn't. There was just whatever, you know.
Right. And then they may have perpetuated the myth that there was. make it more mystique.
Right.
Men would seem capable of doing that, seems like to me, more than women.
Yeah. Well, no, wait a minute.
I mean, operating blind, as it were.
Yeah. Well, I think, that's another part of how American food developed is that, you know, from early on we were cooking blind because, and it continues to go on today. I mean, new immigrants have the same experience that, you know, that the pilgrims had, basically, or, you know, William Riley or whoever. But anyway, so, you know, they were coming to a new country with having grown up with certain tastes, and they had to find substitutes for that.
Right.
So that's all our food is.
I thought maybe that burgoo was related etymologically to the Minnesota thing because it sure is the same recipe.
Yeah. Well, those French traders were all over the place. So
that's right.
God knows where they went.
Thanks for the call this afternoon. Other questions, comments are invited. 333-9455, the number in the Champaign-Urbana area. Anywhere else, toll free, 800-222-9455. Our guest this afternoon, Pat Willard, author of America Eats, On the Road with the WPA. The book is based on material written in the 30s by out-of-work writers and others for the Works Progress Administration. They were to produce, together, a book about local events where food was served. 333-9455, 800-222-9455. So, Pat, why hasn't this project, why did it never come fully to fruition?
Well, a couple of reasons. One was it most of the papers, most of the manuscript is in the Library of Congress, but just as it was really going to press and getting the final editing done, Congress pulled the funding on the Federal Writers Project. Basically, they never liked it. They thought it was, as opposed to the other WPA work initiatives where they were putting, you know, folks together, the Federal Writers were always seen as a bunch of drunks and communists and, you know, just not a good people to fund. So they were always trying to pull funding from the Federal Writers. But right at the end of 1942, 1941, our efforts, or, you know, money was being poured into the start of World War II. So they just cut whatever remaining WPA projects were there. And the papers then were, all the offices were closed, and they were told to send the papers down to Washington.
Let's take another call now. A listener in Urbana, on line one. Hi.
Hi. I listened to the conversation about burgoo. Did you ever come across Southern Illinois chowder?
No. What's
that? Edwards County chowder. It's a whole lot like burgoo.
Uh-huh.
They still make it. West Salem, which is 120 miles south of here, has a homecoming, and they start cooking at about 3 o'clock in the morning, and it'll be ready around noon.
Yeah, that would qualify for one of those.
And my mother gave me a recipe, and it is done by the men do the stirring,
uh-huh.
The women do the chopping.
Oh.
And my mother gave me a recipe that started out with shoot 100 squirrels. And I threatened my squirrels with chowder. And it has mostly, I think they don't use squirrel anymore, but just chicken and beef and every vegetable that's in season in the middle of August. Cabbage, corn, lima beans, string beans.
Yeah, that's definitely.
Tomatoes. And it's really thick.
Yeah.
And they cook. The recipe I have is for 1,000.
Oh, my gosh.
Oh, that
accounts for all those squirrels.
Well, that definitely identifies it as one of these dishes.
It's right around. It's just directly south of Champaign-Urbana. And the extent of where they make it is not much bigger than the county, which is uh-huh. the second smallest county in the state.
Do you have any idea how it came together?
I have no idea.
Uh-huh.
What it's used, the money raised in this homecoming, they call it, every year it supports the cemeteries.
Mm-hmm.
The original settlers were Moravians from South Carolina, North Carolina, I mean, from Old Salem.
Mm. So maybe they were bringing their Brunswick stew recipes over and needed a new name for them.
Maybe so. They were German and German-speaking.
Okay. Well, that's an interesting. That would be interesting to try to figure out the lineage there.
Yeah, I don't know why it's called chowder.
Yeah. It's amazing.
Yeah.
And is it good? So do you like it? Is it good?
I like it if I can forget there's chicken in it. I really like chicken. I usually pick out the lima beans and eat them.
Yeah.
Because I really like them. But it's kind of stringy.
Yeah, it's all stringy.
Really thick.
Well, the idea of squirrel was a main ingredient in all the other dishes, too, at one time. Because, I think that they were so plentiful in the fall and late summer because they're all out, gathering. So they kind of like just were thrown into the pot. But modern sensibility just kind of took that out for chicken.
The University of Illinois campus has a lot of big, beefy squirrels.
Well, then they might be pretty good.
I just wondered if you had encountered it, because it is a really very narrow geographic range that I think it's in.
No, I haven't. And so it's made in the fall. The homecoming's in the fall?
It's in the late summer.
Okay. And it's usually a fundraising.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And then some big families sometimes make one cauldron for a reunion or something. But this is, the town is laid out on a square.
Uh-huh.
And one whole side of the square has these cauldrons that are now, they used to be, have wood fires, but actually, my father arranged for them to be gas-fed.
Oh, okay.
Which makes not as much smoke.
Yeah. But they're big black cauldrons, like witches.
Yeah, they're and the stirrer is like a broomstick with a cricket bat on it.
Yep. That's what they use in Minnesota.
Yeah.
Wow.
Well, thanks for the call this afternoon.
Okay, thank you.
You're very welcome. 333-9455, 800-222-9455. Let's go and take another call. A listener in Champaign on line two. Hi.
Good afternoon. Once again, a very good program. I was just wondering if your guests ever came across catfish stew in her canvassing of these recipes.
No, but the federal writers did. There's lots of different recipes for it too. I couldn't find a modern version for it though, where they would serve it as part of like a fish fry. And this was down in the papers that mention them are down in Alabama and South Carolina.
Right.
On
South
docks.
Carolina.
Yeah.
South Carolina is where I was introduced to it.
Okay.
Many, many moons ago when I was a college student, and that's been 30-plus years.
Yeah.
And never had it before, but it was excellent.
Really? And so where did you have it?
Well, actually, I had a friend in college who had a family member that lived in the city that we were going to school. and we went to his home, and he had this big pot going. I mean, he had coals and what have you under it, and that's where I was introduced, and it was a great meal.
Really?
Comfort food. And as a college student, we needed all the comfort food we could possibly get.
Well, it was one of the dishes I really looked forward to having, and I couldn't find it.
Very good. Thank you.
Okay.
Thanks for the call. Next, we take a call from a listener in Champaign. No, excuse me, from Urbana, line 3. Hi.
Hi. Another great show. I'm really curious as to how you figured out where and when to show up at these different places to meet. So if we were to want, if someone wanted to retrace your steps to find these different places, would you explain that?
Well, I got this huge calendar. What I did was I read through the manuscripts and tried to arrange the different stories around themes that I thought were coming out. And so I would then look at the internet was a great help. I took the original town where the papers or the story was portrayed, and then I would go on the internet and find out if it was still there or if the dishes that they were talking about were still part of that. And a lot of times I found the information on the web, but just as equal amount of time, I would have to, I called a lot of little bitty newspapers and the town librarian and the places like that or I would go to call a college and ask to speak to someone like in culinary history and try to pick their brains. Also a lot of times I sort of knew what I wanted to find out, and I would just get in a car and drive and hope I found it. And that wasn't always the most efficient way, but I ended up finding, if I didn't find exactly what I wanted, I found something more surprising or wonderful. I mean, that was the great thing about doing this research, is just going out and finding out what was there. And I got lost a lot of times. So, and when you get lost, you find cool stuff too. So.
Yeah.
I highly recommend getting lost when you're doing research.
Yeah, get off the main highway.
Yeah, you got to get off the main highway. I mean, one of the things that when I first started this project, a lot of people were saying you're just not going to find anything. It's just a wasteland out there, and it's not. You do have to get off the highway, but it's definitely not a wasteland.
Yeah. Well, it was Veterans Day, Armistice Day, that led you to want to look into High Springs, Florida.
Right.
And that didn't pan out, so you thought Memorial Day.
Right. And that was one of my best. I loved to find the thing I did for Memorial Day. But it also led me to believe that, you know, I couldn't take these papers for verbatim, because these writers, first of all, a lot of them weren't trained journalists and or writers even. So, you know, they thought nothing about making things up just to satisfy the demands of the editors. So for this one thing, the Veterans Day, I called up the Chamber of Commerce, and this guy just had a field day with me thinking I was the stupidest girl under the sun, because I was looking for, it was called a Armistice Day Peanut Festival, and they didn't grow peanuts in the area. They never grew peanuts in the area. They never had this kind of festival. So I was like, oh, no. So that's when I started looking for another holiday.
Yeah, and that was Memorial Day, and that led you to Bowlesburg, Pennsylvania. Tell us about the guys there who roast the pig.
Well, first of all, I think everyone under the sun should go to Bowlesburg at least once in their lifetime during Memorial Day. It truly is a memorable occasion. But I was just walking. It's a little, extremely little town. I think it's 5 blocks long. And on one of the side streets, I saw these guys with this drum, and smoke was pouring out of it. And it was about 11:30, and they were, they'd been having some really good beer for a while. So they, you know, I moseyed over to them, and I said, you know, what's in the drum? They pick up this drum head, and it's an old oil tank that they got. And they picked this up, and there was the most beautiful pig I'd ever seen in my entire life. And so they start telling me this story about they're all farm boys, and they started this. They just one night, having nothing much to do, decided to try to figure out how to roast a pig. And they've been doing it for 17 years now. So now they're responsible guys who have all went off and, while they're childhood friends, they also went and became members of the national parks. So they raise money for national parks by doing this pig roast. And they're very precise about it. It starts at 3-4 o'clock, midnight the night before, where they're roasting this thing very slowly. And by 3 o'clock the next day, it's ready to have pork sandwiches. And it's just tremendously wonderful and succulent.
And how do they make the horseradish?
Well, it's in Amish. Well, it's not in Amish country, but it's surround. But it's near enough to be influenced by it. They actually take a fresh radish and they grate it and they mix it up with some heavy sweet cream, and that's the horseradish. And so it's very rough and very heavy with the actual horseradish gratings. It's wonderful. I feel like having it now.
Yeah. I was really curious about it because I've never made my own horseradish. I do enjoy it. Not many in my family do, however, so yeah. I'm kind of on my own on this deal. But grated horseradish. So I went online to look up horseradish and how to go about doing it. And that was one of the ways that I came across fresh grated horseradish, folding it into stiffly whipped heavy cream and salt to taste.
Yeah.
And dill weed, you might put that on as well.
Yeah.
And then another way of making fresh horseradish involved adding applesauce.
Ooh.
Add 1 tablespoon fresh grated horseradish to 1 cup applesauce for a condiment to pork dishes.
Boy, I bet that would give a nice sweet bite to it.
Yeah, I think that would be good.
Yeah.
Well, there you go. Now we've got some things
to
make
horseradish.
Yeah, we got some experimenting to do.
Yeah, right.
So, okay, talking about Memorial Day, which is interesting that these guys get together and do this on Memorial Day. Memorial Day is at once a holiday where we have a lot of fun, but yet also we do some serious things, too. We decorate graves.
Yeah.
And that gets me to one of the most interesting chapters of your book, and that is the meal following a funeral.
Yeah.
And there's an account from Indiana in the book that's very, very moving. I don't know if you have the book there with you.
I do, yeah.
Pages 185 to 187. And maybe you would give us some sense about how this has changed. Often now we do share a meal following a funeral.
Right.
But it's not the same for a number of reasons.
Well, yeah, this was one of my favorite stories when I found it in the papers. What I loved about what I insisted on having this chapter in the book is because our ritual has changed so much, and it's sad to say, but while I was writing this, writing the book, my father-in-law died, and so the story that I tell after this is the story of his own feast after his funeral, and what happens is because we're so busy, and particularly women are so busy, and more importantly, I think, because we're so far flung, our relatives don't live with us anymore. They don't even live in the same town. So our community is definitely more spread thin. What happens when a funeral happens these days is what I think is very typical for what happened to my father-in-law's, was that people were coming from all over the country. No one really had a home to kind of sit and make a meal. certainly they couldn't bring covered dishes on the airplanes with them. So we ended up, and I think the funeral industry is taking note of this, the funeral home had a separate hall they call a community hall, and they would set up a meal for us. And it was a nice little gathering. We had time to do what is typical at these affairs. We told stories, and we got to meet the person who married Cousin Mary and things like that. But what was lost was, first of all, the comfort of homemade food, and then the reminiscence that happened at these family, tight family affairs, where you remember the dishes that certain relatives were famous for, and you, the family dish, actual plates and things were used. So it's a much more ingrained, private mourning period that kind of helps you more along. Our experience was in this little community house behind the funeral home. It was just, okay, the meal was over, and then everyone left, and that was it. It was like going to a restaurant. So part of the comfort and part of the real need to privately mourn and get through this is gone. You know, it shifts away. So it broke my heart that we don't, that ritual seems to be lessening.
Mm. It does seem, though, that we might go to someone's home, a family member's home, after all the formal
right
things, and there will be
casseroles.
Be
a cake or a casserole, yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. And, you know, I hope that continues, because you need it at that time.
Mm. How did you become interested in food as a way of looking at culture?
I think about this a lot. I mean, I'm a writer more than a cook, and I'm certainly don't have the academic background that a lot of culinary historians have. But what I think it comes from my own experience growing up. I grew up in a working class neighborhood, working class family, surrounded by people who really knew how to cook. My mother was an incredible cook, and she came from a long line of the Irish cook in the, you know, rich people's houses. They're my relatives. So we had all this knowledge. I mean, the kitchen was the place where everyone sat down, and we were expected to, my sister and I and my brother were expected to know how to cook, and it was a mark of a person if you knew how to cook. And so out of that, though, it was just being in a kitchen and hearing stories and listening to how people talked while they were eating and seeing, observing what happens at the table. That really always intrigued me. So I saw it, and all my books kind of touch on this. It's a way to tell something about ourselves. You know, they're not so much cookbooks as they're storybooks about people and their experience with food.
Hmm. What does America Eats reveal about who we were in the 1930s, and does it inform us at all about who we are today?
Well, there's a couple of things. One, and this was kind of one of the reasons why a lot of editors and publishers had a problem with just doing the original papers. They are of their times. So, for instance, there's a very strong racial feelings through here. I mean, in the sense that, for instance, I feel it more in what's absent in this book. For instance, there was extremely few, if any, like one or two mentions of the Chinese immigrants or any immigrant group who was not in America that they thought should be in America. Like at that time, Italians from the southern part of Italy were considered, you know, like fourth-class citizens. So so their recipes are not, and they're not even mentioned. There was a lot of back and talk among the writers and the editors, administrators about who was enough of American. So the papers reveal a real strong, as you would expect, a strong preference for Protestant whites. They do give some
some nod to the fact that African Americans are the backbone of American cooking, but they keep that on the down low, sort of. What the papers couldn't help but reveal was the fact that the unique wonderfulness of our recipes and cooking was because we are a nation of so many different tastes, and that we have to meld these all together. So the recipes that we really adore come from a tradition of sharing and using our imagination on things. What's reflective of it in today is that we're much more culturally diverse and willing to go to other tastes and to experiment with that. So the diversity is much more of an accepting notion to how our cooking is developing.
Mm. There we have to leave it. I'm sorry to say we're out of time. Thank you so much for joining us today.
Thank you.
My
thank you
pleasure.
To your listeners.
And I'd love to have you on again. Maybe we could talk again about this or other topics.
I'm here.
Okay.
I'm hanging out.
All right. Pat Willard, thank you so much.
Thank you, Celeste.
Pat is the author most recently of America Eats on the Road with the WPA, the Fish Fries, Box Supper Socials, and Chitlin Feasts that Define Real American Food. The book is published by Bloomsbury.